Okay, so we're still on lecture three. And it actually has two more parts, but we'll just only do the next part, and then we'll just shove the last part in tomorrow's lecture, where it's more naturally. So we wanted to present a parameterization of nilpotent orbits. And so recall that we have a group defined over the integers, et cetera, et cetera. And so we require that P, remember our field is a finite extension of QP, P as a function of G has to be fairly large in order to make this work. And I'll discuss why when we get there. So let's start with an example. So recall, you were supposed to do an exercise when P is not 2. SL2K has 5 nilpotent orbits. And these are represented by well, 0, theta, 0, 0, where theta runs through the set, 1, well, I guess 0 would be the obvious place to start, 1, epsilon, var pi and var pi epsilon, where epsilon is any unit which isn't a square. Okay? So you have the zero orbit, and then just as in the real case, the regular orbit, which is one orbit over the closure, breaks into the number of square classes for the field. Okay, so we're supposed to do something with the building, so let's look at the building. So what do we have? So we know that, the apartment, there's no buildings in this set of lectures. So what do we have? So we know that the fundamental chamber for the action of W tilde on the apartment is just an edge, and we take its closure, we get the endpoints, and so then we have these. What are the groups over the residue field? Here we had SL2, here we had GL1, and here we had SL2 again. And then, of course, we have their associated Lie algebras. Okay. And so on the next line, let's just write down representatives for distinguished orbits in LF. Okay, so what does distinguished mean? Distinguished means that the orbit is nilpotent and does not intersect a proper rational Levy subalgebra. Okay, so for SL2, this means that it has to be regular because the only proper Levy is the GL1, and that only has one nilpotent guy zero. Okay, so what do you have? Well, you have 0, 1, 0, 0. That's one representative. Yeah, the regular orbit does not intersect the torus. And of course, over the residue field, it breaks into two parts. And here, you can take epsilon to be any element of F cross, which is not a square. Right. So for some reason, Boston's weather was really bad this year. And so my allergies just started kicking 2 days ago. So these things are going to happen probably a lot because I'm not sleeping. OK. So how many nilpotent orbits does GL1 have? All together. No. like being at church. When the preacher says something, you respond. Of course, it only has one, okay? And you believe that. Okay, and here again you have two. And so I'm going to write them in a slightly strange way. So that, because you remember how this is really, this SL2 occurs as the quotient of the parahoric associated to that vertex mod its pronipotent radical. And that parahoric, this point here is x, is r p inverse p r. And so I'm putting the bar pi inverse in just to acknowledge that this thing is actually embedded in a slightly different way. Okie doke. So then you count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Right? You have five things there, and you have five things here. And so you think, well, there must be some magic going on. And indeed there is. So what's going on? So for those of you taking really good notes, okay. So what's going on? Well, you have the following fact, due to Barbash and Moore. I hope that's correct. And it says the following. If F is a facet in the apartment, and O, well, is any orbit, is any nilpotent orbit in the Lie algebra over the residue field associated to that facet, then there exists a unique nilpotent orbit, which we're going to denote OFO, in G, which intersects O non-trivially. Okay, so this thing lives in LF, but we think of it as living in the Lie algebra by just lifting, you know, just by inflating it, by tacking on the coset GF plus. Okay, so here, what do you see? So what will be the unique nilpotent orbit in the Lie algebra intersecting this coset, non-trivial, or, you know, we have an entire orbit, I've only written down one representative for it, non-trivially, that of course would be when theta is 1. When theta is epsilon, you'll get this guy here. And for the other two thetas involving var pis, you'll get one of these two guys. And then of course for the zero orbit, you'll just get the zero guy. So notice that in PGL2, So in GL2, of course, you have the element, it acts on SL2 and therefore acts on the building, and it identifies these two things. So the orbits become identified under the GL2 action. So how to extend this? So the definition. Let's let ID, this will denote the set of pairs FO, such that F is a facet in A, and O is a distinguished nilpotent orbit in LF. And then that's one definition. And then on this set, we extend the equivalence relation that was presented in last lecture to this set. So suppose you have two guys, F1 and O1, or let's say FI, OI bar, such that I is either 1 or 2. And these, of course, belong to ID. If there exists an N in the normalizer in G of A, such that the smallest affine subspace in the apartment K containing F1 is equal to the smallest affine subspace in the apartment containing NF2. And secondly, remember, when we have such an identification, we actually get to an F isomorphism of the associated groups in Lie algebras. So the second condition is that we want O1 bar to be identified under that identification with N O2 bar. Then we write that F1 O1 is equivalent to F2 O2. Okay, so for the SL2 picture, there's nothing interesting going on because here we have up to equivalence, you know, just equivalence on the facets that was introduced last time. These are representatives for the equivalence classes, and you can't get anything interesting going on. Okay, but when you have that in hand, it's not too surprising based on how I've led you here by the nose. You have the following theorem. So suppose that P is large, then there exists a bijective correspondence between ID mod that equivalence relation and the set of nilpotent orbits in G. And how does that work? You send the pair F O bar to O of F O bar, the unique nilpotent orbit of minimal dimension that intersects O bar non-trivially. So the first remark is that if P of G is not sufficiently large, then this is false. And so you just look at, say, SL2. Even though I'm really only dealing with characteristic zero fields, let's just look at this one for an example. If this is not sufficiently large, okay, thank you, then this is false. So, example. So it turns out that for this guy, the number of nilpotent orbits has an infinite number of nilpotent orbits. But when you come over here and look at this picture, well, you're looking at SL2 over the field with two elements. That's what you're going to get here, here, and here you're going to get GL1 over the field with two elements. And it turns out that there's only one orbit there that's distinguished. Okay, so 3 is not infinity, so you're in trouble. And the reason it breaks down is because in the proof of this theorem, you use, in a big way, Jacobson-Morozov theory over the residue field, and that stuff just doesn't work unless P is bigger than, for a simple group, something like the Coxeter number plus 1 or some such thing. Okay. So, a bunch of examples. So let's start with SL3. And of course, I'm always assuming that P is sufficiently large to make it work. So how many nilpotent orbits does SL3 have? Well, you know from the Jordan Jordan canonical form that you're going to have, well, if this were GL3, you'd have the regular, subregular, and the zero orbit. So you have at least 3. And it turns out that when you go to SL3, the subregular, there's only one. The zero orbit, there's only one. But the regular orbit breaks up, depending on the number of cubic extensions. And so this number becomes 2 plus 3 times the index of the cubes. Well, let's see if we can get that from the picture. So we've already discussed how these three edges are equivalent, right? And what do we have here? We have SL3, SL3, SL3. The edges are all GL2s, and this is GL1 cross GL1. GL1 cross GL1, the Lie algebra of that thing has one distinguished orbit, the zero orbit. On each of these edges, we have a GL2, and GL2 has exactly one distinguished orbit, the regular orbit. And SL3, well, how many orbits does SL3 have over the finite field? It has the index of the cubes in F cross. That you get three times. Okay, so we add this up. We get 1 plus 1 is 2, and then 3 times this number, so we get this number. It's good. And one can visualize in one's head exactly what the cosets are, yeah, but I'm not going to write them down. So how about SP4? This is an extremely interesting group, SP4. It's the first time that things go very wrong. So let's look at SP4. So for SP4, we have a pi over 4, pi over 4, pi over 2 right triangle, like this. And we've decided that, I'll just quickly sketch in the groups. This is SL2 cross SL2. This is SP4, SP4. GL2, SL2 cross GL1, SL2 cross GL1, and this is GL1 squared. Okay, so we're treating life over the finite field as a black box, and so I just tell you, how many distinguished nilpotent orbits does SP4 over a finite field have? It has three. GL2, of course, only has one, SL2 has two. This has 4, 2, 3, and 1. And you add these numbers up, and you better get 16, because from classical results, you know that's the answer. So 4, 8, 9, 6 is 15, and 16. Okay? So I just want to say a word about this. You have to be really careful. So if you have an algebraic or closed field, then there's a really good theory, the Bailey-Carter theory, that tells you all about distinguished nilpotent orbits. Okay? But when you don't have an algebraically closed field, say you have a finite field like we do, there is no theory, which is okay, because we don't care. Amazingly, it just doesn't matter. The only thing we want to do in this whole game is that we want to say, suppose you know what happens over a finite field, then it tells you all about what happens over the p-adic field. And in the end, that's going to help us prove a lot of things, as you'll see soon. So, finally, let's look at SP6. So y'all were supposed to bring in your pictures. All right, so you have to remember that the only two faces, the only two things that get identified under the equivalence relation here are the faces that are labeled with the GL2 cross GL1. Okay? And so it's known from classical results that the number of nilpotent orbits here is 45. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to make a chart. You have your group over F, and you have the number of distinguished orbits in LF. So for SP4 cross SL2, and then you'll have to fill them in on your diagram. Okay, you have 6. SP4 cross GL1, well, it's 3. SL2 cross GL1 squared has 2. SL2 cross GL1 cross SL2 has 4. SL2 cross GL2 has 2. GL2 cross GL1 has, of course, only 1. And GL1 cubed, which of course is not labeled on the diagram, it's the interior of your thing, has 1. So if you put those numbers in and take account of the equivalence relation on the two faces, then you'll get 45, I hope. Oh, right, I didn't finish my comment about SP4. So where does this number 3 come from? Okay, so this is kind of an explanation of why there's no theory like Bailey-Carter over a finite field. So an SP4 of the, this is purely for the experts, okay? So an SP4 over the algebraic closure, you have one regular, I just want to deal with the top two orbits. You have a regular and a subregular. And the subregular orbit intersects the GL2 Levy over the algebraic closure. And you know by looking at the centralizers of these things that when you come down to your base field F, the regular orbit will break into two parts, and the subregular orbit will also break into two parts. Okay? So two of these guys are because the regular orbit breaks into two parts, just like it does for SL2. But the other guy comes from the subregular guy, because what happens is he breaks into two parts, but, you know, rational, for GL2, GL2 only has room for one distinguished orbit over any field. And so the other one has to go somewhere, and it goes here. Okay? In fact, p-adically, the subregular orbit, so you have the regular orbit, that breaks into four parts. Two are here and two are here. The subregular guy breaks into seven parts, I guess. One, 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 and four. Okay? So. What about SP6? What about SP6? Oh, did I not tell you how many things SP6 has? Oh, yeah, it's on the bottom of my chart. Sorry. SP6 has 6. Okay, so that's one nifty parameterization you can do. So what was the point of that last lecture? That last lecture, the point was we have a reductive p-adic group. It has all kinds of structure, which you can encode, and some of that structure you can encode into the apartment. And when you encode that structure, you naturally get finite groups of Lie type occurring. So what we want to do is we want to use the structure theory of finite groups of Lie type as a black box and say something about the structure theory of reductive groups over a p-adic field. And so this is one example. And there'll be another one in tomorrow's lecture where you will be required to recite your line. Okay, so here we are at lecture 3. Okay, so I forget what the title was. You recall the goal. So what is the goal? So we want to take the restriction to some subspace. Of a fairly arbitrarily set of distributions. And we like to say that that's equal to the restriction to some subspace of, well, some well understood distribution. So this would be our homogeneity result, and this is what we're after. So recall that at the end of the first lecture, we decided that this thing here, these well-understood distributions, should be the invariant distribution supported on the nilpotent set. Right? We drew this nice picture of SL2 and R, and we decided that all the orbits were asymptotic to nilpotent cones. So if you took distributions that were supported on some compact set and you looked at, if you just looked at that compact set smeared all over, it was asymptotic to the nilpotent cone, and so it looked like this thing should be the invariant distribution supported on the nilpotent set. Okay, and from your course here, you know that this is equal to this has a basis. Or this is, it's easier to say that this is equal to the linear span of of the nilpotent orbital integrals. Okay, and those things are linearly independent. So what are the fairly arbitrary distributions going to be, and what's that subspace going to be? Well, so just remember, what we do, so you had your nilpotent cone here, and we pretend that you could actually do this p-adically, so you took some lattice L, and then you smeared that thing around. Where would this one be? Something like this. Okay. And these lines are asymptotic to the nilpotent cone. And then we decided that, if you just looked at functions which were invariant with respect to the lattice L, and supported, they're going to have to be supported somewhere near this thing in order to have the distributions we're interested actually be non-zero, then you could kind of cover this thing with L. And so this space here should be something like CC G mod L, and the fairly arbitrary distribution should be invariant distributions supported on the closure of the G orbit of L. So what will L be? And that turns out to be almost the correct thing. It's not quite. So for us, our space of functions is going to be the Lie algebra analog of the Iwahori-Heke algebra. Okay. And the question is, what is the set of fairly arbitrary distributions? Well, we have the following amazing, I find it amazing, we have the following neat result. So fix an alcove C in the apartment. And so GC is going to be the Lie algebra analog of the paraheric, which we discussed in last lecture. Okay, so I'll write down a couple examples in just a second. So we have the neat asymptotic result, which you should think of as a confirmation of this picture. So lemma, and how'd I state it? So for all x and y in the apartment, we have that gx is contained in gy plus the nilpotent set. Okay. So, proof by picture. So here you have SL2. Let's say this is C, here's X0, here's X1, X2. So I just write down what is G sub F, because remember these things only depend on the facet that X belongs to. So here you get those guys in SL2, all of whose entries loop in the ring of integers. For C, you get R with the prime ideal back down there. At X1, you're going to get, I want to keep these all in the same line. So I'm just going to redraw this so it's a little smaller. You get R, P, R. Here you get R, P inverse, P, R. One more over, you get R, P inverse, R, P squared, etc. Okay? So as you move to the right, what happens? Well, the lower left-hand thing is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, right? And the upper right-hand thing is getting larger and larger and larger, p minus 2, p minus 3, et cetera. So it's clear that this one is contained in this, if I just put a 0 here, say, plus the set of matrices of the form 0, 0, 0, x, which are, of course, nilpotent. Okey-doke. So this guy is contained in this guy. Plus things of this one. And that's clearly nilpotent. And of course, this is just how life always works. So we can actually prove that. Start. It should be in the top. Nope. Nope. R is contained in P to the minus 1. Okay? Oh, that would be an interesting concept to label everything backwards. So how do you prove this thing in general? A real proof, so to speak. So let V, so remember this A is just a vector space, so just let V be the vector from X to Y. So then what do you have? By definition, you have G of X. That's the Lie algebra of A, take the R points of that thing, plus the sum over all roots alpha, all integers n, such that alpha plus n at X is greater than 0, of the subgroups G alpha plus N sitting inside G alpha. Okay, just what its definition is. So you can rewrite this as the Lie algebra of A, R points of that thing, plus sum over roots alpha, sum over integers N, such that alpha plus N, sorry, not any root, of course. I want to use V somehow, so you use V by requiring that alpha of V be greater than or equal to 0. And alpha plus n at x has to be greater than or equal to 0. Sorry. G alpha plus n. And then you take the sum over all those roots, for which, of course, so you get the same business here, and you change the requirement to alpha v be less than 0. Okay? So you've just broken up your lattice into two parts. Part consisting of those things for which the pairing between alpha and V is greater than or equal to 0 plus the torus part, and then the other part. So then you note that since the pairing, you know, when the pairing between alpha and V is greater than 0 or equal to 0, that means that alpha plus n of y, well, that's alpha plus n at x plus v, and that is alpha plus n at x plus alpha v, which is greater than or equal to alpha plus n at x. Okay? So that means that calculation shows you that this entire part here sits inside of gy. Right? Because if this number is greater than or equal to 0, then this one certainly will have to be as well. And this, well, that's nilpotent, because you're just looking at root spaces in a certain direction. So you're done. And so, since most of you are graduate students, I should say that I spent an entire summer proving results like this for GLN, and with using characteristic polynomials and all this other business, And then in the end, that's it. So sometimes that happens. Okay, so why did we do this? We did this to justify our intuition from the real case. And so now we have to define a couple things, and then we'll be able to set everything up correctly. So definition. So we have our fixed chamber C floating around. So G sub zero is defined to be the union over all facets contained in the closure of C of the G orbit of GF. Okay? This is called the set of compact elements. And so for GLN, and I suppose, but I've never checked for any classical group, this is the set, so for GLN, we have GLN 0. That's going to be the set of n by n matrices, such that each eigenvalue, such that the valuation of the eigenvalues of x are greater than or equal to 0. Okay, and so that's why we call it the set of compact elements. But we have the following corollary to the lemma that we just proved, and that is that for all x and a, we have that g0 is contained in gx plus n. And, well, so in particular, so really nail things down, in particular, g0 is contained in gc plus n. So how do we prove this? So we use the following results of Bruhat and Fitts, which you've already seen, I think. So the proof goes like this. So from Bruhat and Fitts, you have that you can write G as GX W tilde GC. Right? So, for any facet F sitting inside of the closure of C, and for any G in G, we have that G of GF, right? That's what we're interested in looking at. G0 is the G orbits of the GF. Well, let's write this G as K, N, L. So that's K, N, L of GF. Of course, L belonging to GC, GC you should really kind of think of as the Borel sitting inside of GF. It's going to fix this. So this is equal to K, N, GF. And the question is that contained in gx plus n? Well, this is true if and only if ngf is contained in k inverse gx plus n. K n being invariant, so we don't have to carry the k over there. But k belongs to gx, so k inverse of gx is gx. And so then the question is n of gf contained in gx plus n? But n of gf, is, if you just trace through the definitions, this is just g of nf. And so the lemma tells us that this is true. So our motivation, together with this statement right here, leads us to think that the following is true. That this subspace here should be replaced by functions which are compactly supported on G and invariant with respect to GC. What should our arbitrary distributions be? Our arbitrary distributions should be things that are compactly, you know, invariant distributions with compact support. The space of function will again be compactly supported functions on G, invariant with respect to GC. And then we've decided that our well-understood distributions should be J of N. So that's what we think should be true. In fact, that's what's true. Theorem. Okay, and it was originally proved by Walter Berger for unramified classical groups. And it says this. Okay, so unexpectedly, I can actually tie this into the previous lecture of Tom Hell's. Okay, so what should the fundamental lemma for the Lie algebra do? Right, there is such a thing. What should it do? It says, it should say that if you take, so in the notation that we've established, this is going to be a hyperspecial parahoric subgroup. Okay, that x0, that origin, is going to be give us a hyperspecial parahoric. So we're actually interested in comparing orbital integrals evaluated at the characteristic function of that, of the Lie algebra version of that. Okay? So you're supposed to take orbital integrals, certain orbital combinations of orbital integrals on your endoscopic group and certain, and that evaluate them at the analog of this for the endoscopic group, and that's supposed to be equal to certain combinations of orbital integrals on your group evaluated at this guy, right? That was the whole point. Well, where does this thing live? This thing lives here, right? It is certainly such a function. Now, an orbital integral, mu sub x of this guy is going to be zero unless x lives here, right? So this is, in fact, the correct space of distributions to be interested in. And so what this does is it reduces, it's not clear that this is completely helpful, but it reduces your questions of proving the fundamental lemma to questions of doing the same thing for nilpotent orbital integrals between your endoscopic group and your original group. This is amazingly difficult, it turns out. Well, the whole business, I guess, is difficult. And you know, so you get books like this written on this subject. Oh, it's a nice book. So I'll pass it around. See, this is me when I started reading it, and I still don't understand. We should look at the picture. It's a good picture. Okay, but that's not all you get. Okay? You also get the following amazing statement, which is not on this piece of paper. So that's part one of the homogeneity result, and here's part two. Part two says that for any distribution that's compactly supported, we have that the restriction to this favored test space of functions, right? So the Lie algebra analog of the Ewell-Hori-Heck algebra. So if you look at T restricted to that thing, you'll get zero if and only if the restriction to the following space of functions. So you sum over the facets in the closure of C of the functions which are supported on GF and invariant with respect to GC. And you plug in T, and if that's, you know, you get zero if and only if you get zero on this side. So what does this say? This says that a dual basis for this thing can be chosen in this set of functions. Okay? 2 says. A dual basis for the restriction. So compactly supported functions on G, which are invariant with respect to GC, distributions which are compactly supported can be found in. I guess are remarks. So that's remark one. And the second remark is that this is an extremely special reason. There is a much general, more general version. There exists. Somehow we're really only looking at the, so to speak, the debt zero situation. I mean, you can change all these zeros to R's, and you'd have to change G sub C to something else, and then you get a similar statement. But I didn't want to do that here. No. Okay, so I wanted to show you, so the only proof we'll do today is why does 2 imply 1? And proof is kind of in quotes because on occasion there'll be things left to the, that you'll have to say we believe or whatever. So let's look at this. This is really very nice. And this board's probably... Actually, we'll finish with the proof. Just let me give you 2 applications. And then we'll come back to the proof. So the first application, so you all have studied the local character expansion. You have the Harris-Chandra-Hell local character expansion. So what do you get? You get a sharpened version. Of the Harris-Chandra. Character expansion. And it goes something like this. So suppose that pi v is an irreducible smooth, so an irreducible admissible representation of G. And suppose there exists an x in the apartment such that the fixed vectors with respect to the pro-unipotent radical of the parahoric associated to x are non-zero. Okay, so such a representation, as discussed on the first day, is said to have depth zero. So when you're in this situation, then it's true that for all x, I'll have to explain this notation. For all regular semi-simple topologically nilpotent elements, so that's the Lie algebra analog of topologically unipotent, which was discussed earlier. So for all regular semisimple topologically nilpotent elements, you have theta pi at x of x or is equal to the sum over nilpotent orbits, certain coefficients depending only on the orbit and pi times mu sub o hat at x. And of course, this is all assuming that p is sufficiently large so that exponential map makes sense on this neighborhood. So what is g0 plus? So g0 plus, this is a set of topologically nilpotent elements. And by definition, it's the union over facets contained in the closure of C of the g orbit of G. GF plus. Okay, so for GLN, you're going to be looking at those elements x, such that the valuation of the eigenvalue of x is greater than 0 for all eigenvalues of x. Or alternatively, if you're in some kind of classical group, right, this is equal to those x in the Lie algebra such that x, I guess, to the p to the n goes to 0. Wherever this makes sense, right? I mean, what does that mean for G2? I don't know. But for GLN, you can certainly make such a statement. Okay, so that's one application. Here's another application. You get a sharpened version of the Schleicher-Germ expansion. Okay, so by taking the Fourier transform of statement number one, you end up with something like this. For all x compactly supported and regular so for all x living in the compact elements and regular semisimple, you'll have mu sub x hat is equal to gamma o x mu sub o hat on, again, a set of topologically nilpotent regular semisimple elements. And this is exactly what you expect, of course, because as I believe Bob discussed when he was discussing harmonic analysis on Lie algebras, that expansion is the Lie algebra analog of the Harish-Chandra-Hell expansion. Okay, and then the final application, which we'll take up tomorrow with lots of interesting calculations, is that book that's going around. Okay. So one thing you would like to do is for example, when I was discussing the Lie algebra version of the fundamental limit, you're going to have to actually understand what sorts of distributions are stable and supported on the nilpotent set. And this turns out to be, we're not going to get anywhere near answering that question, but we'll show you how to start. Kind of. Okay, so now, proof that 2 implies 1. Good, just enough time. Okay, so suppose we know 2. So then the restriction to the sum over f in the closure of C, the functions which are supported on GF and invariant with respect to GC of T. So this thing is 0 if and only if the analogous result for the Fourier transform is true. So for the Fourier transform, you'd have the sum over f and c bar. So suppose you take a function supported on the lattice gf and invariant with respect to the lattice gc, and you take its Fourier transform, what happens? Well, local constant c gets switched with support, right? And so this becomes function supported on gc plus and invariant with respect to gf plus. But GC plus mod GF plus is the nil radical of the Lie algebra of the Borel corresponding to C and F. GC plus mod GF of the Borel GC mod GF. Right? We discussed all this last time, that this is just how life works here. So this thing is 0. Okay, I'm going to continue. So this is like a side comment. if and only if, and it's not hard to show this. T hat at the characteristic function of the lift you get. Okay. Okay, so I have to explain what does this mean. So this here is the characteristic function of the lift of the orbit O over the finite field. And we're using exactly the notation that was used at the beginning of the lecture. Okay? And then it's actually, in this context, it's extremely easy just using the basics of induction and restriction. So this is also not hard. But it, so it's not a matter of belief, it's just a matter of sitting down and doing it, to show that that happens if and, oops, yeah, equals zero, if and only if, what's my notation here, F O bar equals zero for all F O and I D up to the equivalence relation. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, we know that this set here corresponds bijectively to the set of nilpotent orbits in the Lie algebra. So that means that the dimension of the left-hand side of number 1 is less than or equal to the number of nilpotent orbits. Okay? Parameterization result, we get the dimension as a complex vector space of the restriction to CC G mod GC of JG0 is less than or equal to the number of nilpotent orbits. Okay, because we have this dual basis consisting of things which are in one-to-one correspondence with nilpotent orbits. Good. But on the other hand, this thing contains the restriction to functions which are compactly supported on G and invariant with respect to the lattice GC, JN, right? Every nilpotent element belongs to G0. And because nilpotent orbits are homogeneous, we know that the dimension of this is equal to the number of nilpotent orbits. So the dimension of this, so this number is less than or equal to this number, so these two things must be the same. Okay, and notice, we didn't have to know anything about which orbits are actually distinguished over the finite field. We just used it. And I really don't know, except for the cases I've worked out. Okay, see you tomorrow. Oh, see you.